You are listening to the Corrections Connection News Network, CCNN, your weekly news source for the corrections and criminal justice industry.
Welcome to today's live talk. I'm your host, Michelle Gasso. Today we will be speaking with Ryan King, a research associate with the Sentencing Project in Washington, D.C. His research specialization is the American correctional system, with a particular concentration on the radiating effects of incarceration among individuals, families, and the community at large. His most recent work is an analysis of the localized impact of felony disenfranchisement laws in Atlanta, Georgia. His past research has included a national profile of life sentences, an analysis of the economic effects of siting a prison in a rural community, a study of the effect of three strikes laws on the prison population, and a statistical profile of state prison inmates incarcerated on drug charges. Mr. King has appeared in the national press, including the New York Times and the Washington Post, as well as local and national talk radio programs to discuss sentencing and corrections issues, including NPR's Talk of the Nation. Today he will discuss sentencing reform and some of the latest legal developments around this issue. So welcome to today's live talk.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
Thanks so much for joining us.
Sure.
We first wanted to start with sort of the latest buzz in sentencing guidelines, and it's been a hot topic before the Supreme Court and last term and current term, and I was wondering if you could update everyone here about what these cases are, what they're about, and what maybe some predictions might be for their outcomes.
Sure. Well, beginning in about June, end of June this past year, a decision came down from the Supreme Court, widely known as the Blakely decision. And basically, the Blakely dealt with the state sentencing guidelines in Washington State. And essentially, the way the rule is in the past, it's sort of a complex, but just to put it in a nutshell, the way the rule has been in the past was that when, at the sentencing phase of a trial, in addition to the factors that were proven in front of a jury, so the particular charges of the case, that could be taken into account to determine one's sentence. Mm-hmm. There were also factors that could be considered above and beyond those that had been proven in front of a jury. Those could be taken into account for sentencing purposes. So what we could have was somebody who could be convicted for a drug charge, and that would fall under a certain range in the sentencing guideline. And then a judge had the discretion above and beyond that to take into consideration factors such as past arrests, reported behavior that a person may have engaged in they hadn't been convicted of, and those could also add to the length of one sentence. So what we had was basically people being sentenced to prison for lengths of time that included some factors that had not been proven in front of a jury. The Supreme Court in the Blakely decision struck that down and basically said that for anything to go above and beyond the guideline range, for any sentence to go above and beyond the guideline range, if you're going to use any other factors to go above that range, you're going to need to prove those factors in front of a jury. The impact of this decision basically was to throw the whole sentencing world up in the air, and we've been tumbling ever since and waiting for further guidance. All summer long and into the early autumn, there's been this debate about does the decision for the Washington State sentencing guidelines impact the federal sentencing guidelines. That's been the really $64,000 question. Mm-hmm. The court wasn't clear and didn't give guidance, but for experts who look at it, really sort of the consensus around town is that from the language of the decision in Blakely, it's clear that certainly that those requirements do apply to the federal sentencing guidelines, and there's a belief that that the federal sentencing guidelines could not withstand the new test for Blakely. So what happened was in August, the Supreme Court granted cert to two cases, Booker and Fanfan. They're tried together to really address whether the Blakely decision impacts the federal sentencing guidelines, and that's where we stand now. Literally waiting by the moment, there were rumors this morning that the decision from Booker Fanfan, which is argued in October, was going to be handed down. And so we're waiting now to hear sort of what the next step is. Does Blakely apply to the federal sentencing guidelines? And if so, are the federal sentencing guidelines basically unable to withstand the standard under Blakely, and would there be a requirement for basically a rewriting of how sentencing is done at the federal level?
So is there a thought that they took the two new cases so soon to clarify what maybe they didn't say in the previous case?
Absolutely. The cases were taken for that very reason, to clarify the application of the Blakely ruling to the federal guidelines. And they really needed to be done immediately, because immediately after Blakely, throughout July and August, and really since then, different federal circuit courts have been handling the Blakely decision differently. So some courts, you know, it could be in one circuit where a court's going to rule and say that Blakely doesn't apply to the federal system, the guidelines can stand. You can be another court where they say the opposite. And so there was no consistency in sentencing, which is obviously a real problem when it comes to fairness in sentencing. And so there was really an urge for the court to take a federal case as soon as possible, listen to the arguments, and decide, so we'll have a little bit of guidance.
What are the thoughts about how the Supreme Court might rule on this?
There's really a lot of discussion. I think it seems to me, over the last few months, I've been to a number of seminars and discussions and spoken with people. It's sort of been the issue since the end of June that's kept all of our attention for people who study sentencing. And I think that it's been my sense that the federal sentencing guidelines they will find that Blakely applies to them. And that there is a real threat that the federal sentencing guidelines, the question is whether there's a severability, and basically whether a portion of the guidelines can stand, they can be amended, mm-hmm. or if they have to be completely thrown out and a new system put in its stead. Either way, the belief is that the federal sentencing guidelines are going to somehow be impacted by Blakely, by Booker Fanfan, and that the legislature, the Senate and the House, beginning next term, will have to address the results of the Supreme Court decision by either writing a brand new large sentencing legislation or at least amending it in some sort of way.
So would Congress be possibly coming up with new sentencing guidelines?
There would have to be basically a whole new, well, depending on how it's ruled, there
okay.
could be basically a whole new process where the sentencing guidelines would have to be rewritten from scratch, whether they would, but there's also other opportunities. There could be a situation where the guidelines were held to be simply advisory as opposed to compulsory guidelines. There could be just certain amendments that need to be made. There's a lot of different options that are out there. I think that it's pretty widely held that Congress is going to have to get involved to some degree. And that adds a whole new element, a whole new variable as to what the future would hold for sentencing.
You're kind of leading me into my next question, which is, what's the sense and what are the trends of sentencing reform? Is the federal government in sort of one side and the states on another, or is everybody kind of on the same page, or is everybody all over the place in terms of where people are going with sentencing?
I think largely the federal and state systems have been a little bit opposed. The state systems, particularly in response to the budget crises in the last few years, have been addressing some of the sentencing legislation. Now, a lot of these changes have been modest. Certain crimes that in the past may have triggered mandatory minimums in some states no longer do. There have been efforts to divert low-level drug offenders in a number of states into treatment rather than prison. We're not talking about wholesale reform of a state sentencing approach,
right.
but we've seen minor modifications at the state level, and an acknowledgement that the growth of the prison system over the last 30 years has put a lot of financial pressure on states, and it hasn't really, they're basically in a position now where I think a lot of states are realizing they can't continue to build their way out of it.
Right.
Now, at the federal level, it's a little bit of a different story, and I think that the likelihood that whatever comes out of the Booker-Fanfan decision and whatever modifications Congress needs to make are going to be reform-minded is pretty optimistic. I think in reality, looking at the direction of sentencing legislation for the past 25, 30 years and looking at the makeup of the Senate and House as it stands now and as it will stand in the new term, the likelihood of any sort of reform coming out of modifications made to federal sentencing is pretty unlikely. I think in what we will see is at the very best a status quo and perhaps even ratcheting up of some of the ways that sentencing are handled at the federal level.
I might go back to that a little bit. I wanted to sort of chew on that for a second. I also wanted to ask you a little bit about things happening over on the West Coast in California. There was obviously, last week, a lot of people heard about Proposition 66 and the possibility of the repeal of three strikes in California. It didn't pass, but a lot of people voted for it. And I'm kind of wondering if you've been following that and what, you know, people might take from that as, you know, for sentencing reform trends and statewide anyway.
I think the failure of Proposition 66 was a real indication of the size of the challenges, excuse me, that reform faces at the state level. Rockefeller drug laws and three strikes are two, Rockefeller drug laws in New York State and three strikes in California are two sort of symbols of very harsh criminal justice sentencing over the past 30 years, both of which have received a significant amount of attention, a significant amount of political discussion and research over the time, and a lot of which there seems to be a real groundswell for change and reform in both places. However, New York has been talking about reforming Rockefeller drug laws for years, and year in and year out, and they never seem to be able to get it done. And we sort of see the same thing here in California. There's been a lot of talk for reforming three strikes and making the third strike required be a serious or violent offense as opposed to any offense, so that we don't have a person stealing a piece of pizza triggering a 25-year sentence.
Right.
There seems to be an understanding that there needs to be a change in both cases, but getting it done politically is very difficult. As I said, New York has struggled, and here we see in this Proposition 66 an initiative that about a month ago or so was polling quite strongly, and towards the end there was a significant influx of pressure from Governor Schwarzenegger and also the California Correctional Officers Union, both of which really pushed for voting down the initiative, and at the end it eventually fell by a close margin. So what I use these, both of these sort of examples as a way to caution people who look around and see a little bit of reform and say, okay, here we are, we're moving in the right direction. There certainly is a lot of opportunity and discussion. It's better than it was 5 years ago, no question. However, I think that we need to look at the bigger picture and realize that minor modifications that we make are positive, but if we want to make long-term sustainable change, i.e., Rockefeller drug laws, three strikes, truth in sentencing, these sort of larger sentencing initiatives that we've had in the past. The obstacles are still in place. These are really firmly entrenched policies.
Well, I just wanted to let our audience know that if they're just joining us, we're talking with Ryan King of the Sentencing Project about sentencing reform. I wanted to sort of add a question there. We were just, again, talking about California and three strikes, but what... You know, it seems like there's some public sentiment toward changing some of these things. That maybe things are, at least on the California side, maybe things were too big. Maybe change was too big and needed to be done smaller. And I'm just wondering, what do you see or what do you foresee taking place to make some of these reform changes?
Well, I think that I think you're exactly right. Some of the criticism Proposition 66 was that it was too ambitious. I don't necessarily agree. I think that it was a very sound proposal, but for some people who were supporters of it, were a little disappointed because they felt it was too ambitious. I think if you look at policy change in general, you're correct in that it's often the smaller modifications that are able to get through. And so what I look at is the changes that we've seen, as I was mentioning earlier, particularly in treatment of low-level drug offenders, a real acknowledgement by legislators and policymakers that there are alternatives that are available. Now, whether they're politically expedient at this particular time is still a variable that we need to study a little bit more. But I think that 10 or 15 years ago, a politician coming forward and suggesting that low-level drug offenders should be in treatment and not in prison was political suicide. But now we've got legislators, we've got heads of states, governors coming out and calling for real wholesale drug reform. So I think that grew out of the small minor changes in the early 1990s, drug courts, efforts to get people into treatment, has grown into this much larger movement. So I think that in criminal justice, any change that we're going to see is going to start small and it's going to have to continue to grow. We've got a lot of research out there we've got a lot of alternative pilot programs that are going on. We've got the federal government that's funneling a lot of money into reentry programs now.
Right, right.
At the local level. So I'm optimistic that as those programs continue to take hold and we learn what works and what doesn't work and we get that background of research and data behind us that we can give to politicians and policymakers and say, look, we know a better way. We know a different way. Let's take a look at this and here's why we know it works, because it worked in city A, B, and C. Those are opportunities, but you're exactly right. They're going to start small. I don't think you can't swing for the fences, as they say.
Right,
you've got
right.
to learn to crawl before you can walk.
Right. And I told you I was going to get back to this whole idea of Congress making some decisions about federal sentencing, but I'm kind of wondering if you'd talk a little bit about, maybe to wrap up our discussion today, but talk a little bit about if states are making, or states seem to be kind of making these small movements, and governors seem to be talking about in reforming some sentencing laws, yet there seems to be some real doubt on the part of folks who file a sentencing reform that Congress would make any change in that direction. How can there be such a difference? And then, I hate to pile on another question too, but how does the election of last week, how does that factor in, and possible new Supreme Court justices factor in? Does that make a difference at all?
Well, to get to the first part of your question, mm-hmm. there's a real difference between the way federal law and the way the accountability of federal representatives versus state. The financial pressures on state representatives are much more significant.
Right.
The correctional system, although the federal system is growing largely, it's still small
mm-hmm.
In comparison to state systems. So state systems as a proportion of the state population is much higher than the federal system as a proportion of the nation's population.
So they're not feeling the pressure.
So they
the
don't
states
feel
do.
The pressure quite as much as states do. In some states, we've got correctional budgets can represent 6-7% of the general revenue fund. That's a significant amount of money coming out of the state.
Right.
It's not nearly as significant at the federal level. So federal legislators, I think, are a little bit more insulated from that, and I think that's really to their detriment, because state legislators, I think, are really seeing firsthand, they're hearing firsthand from their constituents the impact of some of these decisions. So they're sort of the canary in the coal mine, in that
right.
they're realizing now, okay, these 30 years of growth, the corrections have been problematic. We need to look into some changes. I'm hoping that the changes at the state level continue to grow, and that federal legislators will acknowledge that and recognize it and realize that at the federal level they can make some similar modifications. As far as election results and potential appointment of justices, I haven't looked at the breakdown of the Senate in terms of new persons coming in and positions on criminal justice issues, so it's hard to say at this point. And I also don't like to just say, well, Republicans are tough on crime and
right.
Democrats are not, because in reality we know that's not necessarily the case. We've seen a number of Republican legislators and governors spearhead reform, and Democrats not necessarily being at the head of the reform movement in some cases. So I think it's important not to draw partisan
sure.
lines. And as far as the appointment of justices are concerned, again, the Blakely decision, which really was seen by many as advantageous to the defense side,
mm-hmm.
Because it was requiring prosecution to prove anything that was going to be necessary to increase the sentence,
mm-hmm.
was the opinion was authored by Justice Scalia.
Mm-hmm.
So we're not talking about sort of the quote unquote liberal end of the Supreme Court pushing reform, and I think particularly. When we look at some of the bigger issues, which are judicial discretion,
mm-hmm.
that's sitting out there in sort of a larger
mm-hmm.
theme in judicial discretion and sentencing, we've seen some of the conservative judges come forward and really speak out for judges being able to retain some discretion, believing that there's too much discretion centered in the prosecutor's seat right now,
mm-hmm.
and it makes the ability for fair justice to be had in the court much more difficult. So I think that, at this point I'm going to sort of hedge my bets and
sure.
not really say one way or the other, because there's just too many variables out there. I've learned in the past that you can't just say, well, you know, this person is this
yeah.
party, so, because it really is. Criminal justice, particularly over the last 15, 20 years, has become a nonpartisan issue. Democrats have jumped right in, and tough on crime has sort of gone on both sides of the aisle. And in many cases, as I said, we've seen a lot of reform pushed by Republicans.
Well, I think either way, it'll probably be an interesting couple of months to watch and see what does happen.
Yes, very much so.
Well, thanks so much for talking with us today. That concludes today's live talk. And thank you again to Ryan Kane for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Well, very happy to have you. Thanks also to our audience for tuning in today. To learn more about this topic, be sure to read this week's articles on the Corrections Connection at www.corrections.com. For CCNN, I'm Michelle Gasso.
You are listening to the Corrections Connection News Network, CCNN, your weekly news source for the corrections and criminal justice industry.